Engage for Success Radio, raising the profile of employee engagement and shining a light on good practice for people who believe there's a better way to work.
So good afternoon and welcome to our radio show number 94, Creating Authentic Organisations, Bringing Meaning and Engagement Back. So I'm Jo Dodds, your host for today. I'm a social media HR consultant working with the Engage for Success movement, leading on digital and social media. The Engage for Success movement, you think I've learnt to say that by now, is an inclusive movement committed to the idea that there's a better way to work by releasing more of the capability and potential of people at work. And we spread the word about employee engagement and shine a light on good practice. And we're widely supported across the UK, involving the public, private, and third sectors. If you go to our website, which is engageforsuccess.org, you can use the orange button in the top right to join in, and you can get onto our mailing list. And if you tweet, please share your thoughts using our hashtag, which is #E4S, and that's with the number 4, to join in the conversation. And do come and join us on our LinkedIn groups. There's one for the guru group, one for the practitioner group, and a couple of other sort of more regionalized groups that have been set up as well. So just do a search for Engage for Success on LinkedIn. And all our social media links are on our homepage on the sidebar under the Connect With Us banner. And if you enjoy our shows, please go to our iTunes profile and give us a rating. That would be really helpful. So today I'm interviewing Lisa Sofianos, who's executive coach and director at Robin Ride Consulting. She's a business author, a creative thinker, and international consultant in leadership and organisation development, and she's based in London. She was a founder of and has been a director of Robin Ride Consulting since 2008 and has worked with clients in both the private and public sectors in the UK, the US, and other territories including South America, the Middle East, Australia, and Eastern Europe. And she partners with businesses to raise levels of employee engagement and increase organisational agility and innovation in response to the rapid change and volatility that characterises the modern business environment. So her book, Creating Authentic Organisations, Bringing Meaning and Engagement Back to Work, which was written by herself and Robin Ride, was published in October 2014 by Kogan Page. And the book makes the compelling argument for the positive impact of individual authenticity on businesses and sets out the management task of creating the conditions to allow employees to fulfil their roles with greater authenticity. And that's obviously going to be the topic of our conversation today. So welcome, Lisa. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
It's really good to have you here. And I particularly like the whole concept of authenticity. So really pleased that I could host the show that you're joining us on. So perhaps you could start by telling us a bit more about yourself. Obviously, I've just done a bit of an intro from your bio, but tell us a bit more about where all this comes from, what you've done in the past and your particular interests.
Okay. Well, yes, probably not much more to add to that very extensive bio. I was finding it hard to recognise myself there, so that was fantastic. I think that the book comes from a real feeling, I think, that most of us have to work or indeed like to work and find it fulfilling, but that because we spend so much time at work, the idea that if that work that we do is somehow getting in the way of us sort of becoming ourselves, you know, understanding ourselves and fulfilling whoever we're meant to be, is actually something that is problematic. The idea that, you know, when by the time that you get to your retirement and then your life starts and you perhaps don't even know, you know, who you are, what you stand for, what your interests are, it's almost a tragedy. So that was a sort of the feeling that compelled me to write the book. And also the idea that I think that in the past, when perhaps work was perhaps more physical and repetitive, it didn't make so many inroads into our sort of imaginative and interior lives as work does now. You know, we could just as easily have sort of an inspiration or an idea about a meeting that we're about to go into when we're, you know, sort of at the cinema with our children or eating our sandwich, as we do within working hours. And so work is making greater and greater inroads, and especially the sort of hyper-availability that we have with modern technology. And so it's increasingly difficult for us to hold those two worlds apart. And therefore, we think it's incredibly important that perhaps, you know, the work of sort of sense-making and understanding who we are takes place in the workplace as well as outside of it.
Mm-hmm. So we talked, didn't we, about work-life balance, and Kathy, our exec director, last week, I can't remember who we were talking to, was saying, you know, how, and I agree with her, that work-life balance, you know, that they're not necessarily two different things, as you've just said, that, as you say, nowadays things are more about just life. So maybe it's not about that balance side of things anyway.
I think it's increasingly difficult, as I said, to hold them apart. I mean, I know that just for myself, there are so many points of access to me in my life. And if, you know, the world is very small now, we are more likely to have international clients. We're more likely to have to work very reactively and quickly in order to respond to challenges. And certainly for me, and I think very many other people, the idea of working hours, even if we're clever about holding apart, just doesn't work. You know, we're sort of oscillating between these two sort of home and sort of private and work sort of personas so quickly that actually it becomes incredibly stressful. You know, I think also one of the things that I talk about in the book is that the workplace culture that we've grown used to and has grown up over hundreds of years and comes from maybe a manufacturing past, certainly in this country, has sort of dictated that, you know, this idea of sort of standardization reproducibility. So we tend to have a sort of workplace language and the way we dress and persona, which is very different to the one we have outside. And I think that it creates an awful lot of tension within us when we're sort of flipping between the two, maybe in the course of one evening or a Saturday morning. You know, we've got the children in one room and we've got a book we're reading, and then we have to sort of flip into office mode. And I know when I'm sort of Skyping, say clients who are in Australia, and I'm very grateful for the ability to be able to do it. But, I'm quite often sort of sitting there in a sort of, you know, very smart top half, my pyjamas and slippers on the bottom half, which to me completely highlights the sort of absurdity of trying to keep these two worlds apart.
Yes, yeah. So in the title of the show, we talked about creating authentic organisations, and clearly that's sort of where this conversation is going. What do you mean by authentic? Let's sort of examine that before we sort of get too deep into it.
Yeah. So certainly for me, the ability to be authentic in the workplace is about having the freedom to bring yourself to the workplace and sort of without sounding trite, I think what that means is to be able to organise your work in the way that best reflects your strengths and maybe to some degree your interests. For example, somebody who perhaps gets a lot of energy from discussion and talking to people is really not going to respond well to a sort of quiet workplace where everybody's in an office, whereas, you know, the opposite is true for somebody who's very introverted. They're not going to find, you know, an open plan, noisy office is going to bring out the best in themselves. So it's the idea that people can sort of furnish the surroundings that allow them to work best, that they can bring more of themselves in as much as, you know, their outside interests and so on, so that the organisation can engage with a far greater breadth of skills and knowledge than perhaps it does traditionally. Because quite often we leave all of our outside interests at sort of the front door of the office, and then we bring in a kind of diminished version of ourselves into the workplace. So to access that, I think, is an enormous benefit to organisations. The other thing, I think, is that people need to be able to make sense of the organisation, you know, its values and culture and strategic intent. They need to be able to question not just the how of what they do in order to organise it in a way that suits them, but also the why of what they do. It may be that there are certain sort of traditions or sort of cultural norms that actually maybe need updating. And so to be able to creatively challenge those is, I think, beneficial to the individual and to the organisation. another thing that we find is imperative to create an authentic organisation is the idea that people can speak freely about anything and everything that's going to impact on the success of the organisation. You know, to sort of name the elephant in the room, you know, sort of face the things that perhaps are culturally have become blind spots.
About the employee voice.
Yes, absolutely. We would absolutely agree with that, that there needs to be a variety of forums, I think, formal and informal, for people to speak. I think quite often organisations are getting much, much better, I think, at getting people to contribute and speak, but they tend to be in a very sort of formal way. And I think that people say different things in different forums. It's the idea of what people say at the water cooler. Quite often, that is where they voice their real opinions and fears about maybe a new initiative in a workplace. And that's where they decide to buy in or opt out, to consent and evade, to sort of nod and smile. And yet when they go back to their desk and they've had maybe some real misgivings or risks that they've identified have not been probed or remain unanswered, they may decide they're just going to go back to business as usual. So I think that employee voice is absolutely essential. Another thing that when if people feel like they're contributing wholeheartedly to the life of the workplace, they're helping to sort of build and uphold the culture, and then they're going to have a greater sense, I think, of accountability to the organisation.
And so why isn't that happening with organisations at the moment? What's getting in the way of that? You talked about, being encouraging of people sharing their views, but perhaps not with that authenticity that we've mentioned. How does that happen, or why isn't it happening?
I think, as I've alluded to you before, I think we come from a long tradition maybe of maybe a manufacturing past where the whole idea was to create efficiency, standardisation. And the idea of variation and variability perhaps, was something that should be sort of eliminated. It was seen as risk. And I think with that, a lot of our sort of individuality was also ironed out. In a modern office, which is probably recognisable anywhere around the world, people dress in a very certain way, they speak in a certain way. There are lots of limitations on how we express ourselves and how we do things, because of modern workplace conventions. And I think also something that comes from that tradition is this idea of, this sort of the command and control and coordinate approach to leadership, which I know that most leaders understand now perhaps it is less and less suitable to this sort of the modern environment of complexity and change and challenges that could come from anywhere. But I think this sort of tradition casts a long shadow, and I think that it actually perhaps is no longer fit for purpose, and we need to really seriously examine the way that we engage with our workforces now as leaders and managers. I think perhaps what we have from the past is more of a kind of parent-child model of leaders and management and workforce, and what we actually should be moving towards is an adult-to-adult model and a recognition that we go to great lengths to employ people who are resourceful and skilled and have initiative. And then sometimes workplace culture acts against that.
And you talk in the book about the death of deference, which is something that David McLeod talks about quite a bit with Nita when they're presenting at conferences, and how, engagement is really important because deference has gone or is certainly not working in the way that it did. What are your thoughts on that? Isn't it essential for the workplace, or does it cause issues if it's not there?
I think that deference, as opposed to maybe respect, is a kind of limiting force in workplaces. I think that deference structures are sort of responsible for sort of handing, for people handing over accountability and responsibility to people higher up the line. There's that famous phrase or saying, isn't it, by Victoria Holt, that the fastest way to kill innovation is to let the boss speak first, because everybody else will fall into line afterwards. So I think that what deference does is it silences people further down the line who feel that even if they are brimming with ideas and inspiration, that they haven't somehow earned their place to say what they are thinking. And even if they do say it, it might not be taken as seriously. But there's also, I think, another thing that is acting in a deference structure, and that is it's essentially a de-skilling place, because people are just not required to be as engaged further down the line if they know that somebody further up the line is going to be the one who's finally signing things off and taking responsibility. And I think another thing that it does is I think in a complex world where we need a kind of plurality of ideas and views and perspectives, to be able to respond quickly to change and challenge, what deference structures do is they kind of narrow things to a point, so that they're actually getting a kind of monoculture. And I think that when you have that kind of, you know, the views of just the few being represented and enacted, then that's when you can have emissions, you know, quite naturally, because people just don't have all the information to hand anymore.
Yeah, so
that they need to make the decisions.
Yeah, sorry.
Sorry, can you repeat that?
So what do you think the leaders need to be doing differently? Because we talk about sort of deference and an alternative perspective on that being respect, but I can see a lot of leaders actually thinking that their people should respect them, and actually they really mean deference, but respect isn't necessarily the same thing, but as a leader they think that's what it is. So how can the leaders be different to have the respect but not in a deferential way, if you like?
Well, I think we should all respect each other. I think that respect is a given, but it's something that we sort of have for one human being, I think, for another. But I think that leaders need to realise that, you know, they have a great influence on organisations. People look to them to get a steer, I suppose, on what the organisation means. They kind of, for a lot of people, you know, they embody the culture and values of an organisation. So I think that the starting point in an authentic organisation is for leaders and managers to model this themselves. They need to be able to speak to people in an adult to adult way. They need to be able to admit when they've made mistakes or they don't know the answer to things. You know, they need to be the ones who are encouraging the dialogue and showing that actually not only will people be listened to, but their suggestions, if they have any merit, will be acted upon. And I think they need to create the safety that's required in an authentic organisation. It's not a comfortable place to be. I think the reason we've had deference structures for so long is because they can become quite comfortable, knowing that you don't have to take the rap if you get it wrong all the time. You can kind of pass responsibility up the line or down the line. So to act authentically, to be fully accountable for yourself and your actions, is not always comfortable. And so leaders can certainly create the safety that's required for that to be the case. And I think that there are all sorts, I mean, we talk in the book about leaders and managers being freedoms fighters. So for us, there are three kind of freedoms that need to be in place for an authentic organisation. And that's the freedom to operate. So that's the freedom to be able to organise your work in the way that best suits you while still meeting the needs of the organisation. And then there's the freedom to speak that we spoke about, and then the freedom to actualise, which is the space to kind of learn and grow and incorporate that learning into your work, and maybe to conduct small experiments to see if you can do something better or faster or create sort of innovations. And I think leaders and managers need to defend and hold open those spaces for people. And also I think that they need to, in order for people to sort of fully understand and align themselves with the organisation's values and cultures and strategic intent, there's an interpretive role, I think, for leaders and managers to make those things relevant to employees and to interpret them in ways that, that make sense to employees in their everyday work.
So some of this stuff has been talked about a lot, and within the movement we talk about it around employee engagement. Why do you think this isn't happening with leaders? What's stopping them doing it?
Well, I think that, as I said, it's uncomfortable. I think that a lot of new leadership thinking is actually how to deal with the issue of what do you do when you don't know what to do. I think there's a difficulty, I think, for leaders to express the fact that they don't know necessarily what to do all the time in an environment which is sometimes battling, quite often changeable and volatile. And I think that we, because of the old deference contract, which is that, you know, we hand responsibility to experts and people in charge because they'll have the answers. And it's very difficult to shake off that mantle and say, you know, well, I have a set of skills as a leader, and you have a set of skills in your work, and you have a set of skills here in yours, and let's work together, you know, to make sure that we're all sort of co-creating an answer here. I think that it's very difficult to throw off, you know, sort of decades and decades of expectation. I think also, you know, many leaders have sort of grown up in the old order of command and control, and they've been rewarded by being promoted, you know, for having those skills. And in some ways we're asking them to sort of jump out of that mindset and that skill set into something new. So it isn't an easy task. But increasingly modern leadership thinking is about, you know, engaging as many views and ideas as possible, because it just isn't possible, especially in complex and global organisations, to have everything you need to hand. You know, I'm thinking of organisations that perhaps have even gone out of business because their sort of leaders and senior team perhaps didn't necessarily understand some of the risks that were happening around them. For example, you know, from sort of online sales or so on, you know, when perhaps their younger sort of staff working on counters and so on, you know, would see how their client base was changing, and probably was sort of, say, in a music shop, were downloading music themselves, you know, and they were changing their habits. But somehow that information wasn't being fed up the line, because everybody was expecting the people in the senior team to already know that and have the answers. So I think it is a big cultural change that's required. I suppose that is, once you've sort of stepped out of that idea that you must have all the answers all the time and be the one who knows, then at least you have the kind of comfort of being able to then engage everybody else in all of those ideas. You know, it takes a lot of the heat off you.
Yes. I know when we had some research done about 18 months ago now with leaders about employee engagement, vulnerability was one of the sort of issues that came up as to why engagement doesn't happen or isn't easy for them, for exactly the reasons you say, that everyone's expecting them to have all the answers and lead. And I guess in some cases it's about, as you said, they that's how they were managed, so they continue to do the same thing. So aside from those sort of individuals, how can organisations as a whole become and demonstrate that they're more authentic?
Well, I think that, and again, this perhaps marries with one of the sort of enablers, which is the idea of strong and public declaration of what the organisation stands for and who they are. Because then once you know what it is you're doing and why you're doing it and where you've come from, it's easy to align with that or to not align with that and to move on to somewhere else. You know, but it's easy for people to get behind something that's very clearly articulated. And also it's easy to see when perhaps organisations are not acting in accordance with that, and so that there is a governance issue there as well. But I think also that organisations have to seriously look at, you know, sort of congruence and alignment. And so maybe, you know, to follow the influence of the organisation as far as it goes, and kind of assess that against the, and assess the impact of that against the, this culture, the culture and the values of the organisation. I think they need to become very transparent. That sort of engenders a high trust environment within and without. I think that they need to get serious about engaging in real dialogue, two-way and adult-to-adult dialogue, and to look at the way that they reward and sanction dialogue as well, not just to encourage people who's perhaps with a great idea just focused on progress, but also perhaps, you know, how do we encourage people who might point at risk as well? Or how do we deal with people who've made an honest mistake when they're trying to innovate? All those sorts of things I think they need to get serious about. Organisations, I think, have to admit when they've made mistakes and share the learning from them. They need to humanise the points of interaction between the organisation, the clients, the customers, inquirers, you know, sort of in order to promote dialogue. I think that, again, this is sort of the different forums that I was talking about before. I think it's important for organisations to really engage with the sort of shadow side, you know, the informal life of an organisation and its clients, where the real sort of opinion forming and sense making happens. And also, I think that they need to make sure that they stick to the deal. You know, they don't change the deal and expect no one to notice. You know, they operate in a world now where it's very, very difficult to keep anything hidden. So, you know, because of social media and so on. So I think that they need to be able to, you know, step up and say, okay, we made a mistake, and act upon it, you know, and maintain the trust.
And that, I guess, leads into some of the conversations going on within the organisation. As you said, how do you sort of facilitate those conversations so that they're the real information rather than, as you say, what people think everyone wants to hear? But I guess the media and the social media stuff really does challenge that, because whilst everything appears to be a lot more open, in some ways you could see that would stop people wanting to be open because it could, you know, potentially cause an issue. So you can see, I mean, there's been lots of examples of organisations where, you know, things have come out in the end but weren't being made public at the time. I mean, Nita talks a lot about the Staffordshire Hospital issues, you know, that people knew, but, you know, they weren't asked or they weren't given an opportunity to say anything. But then with the way that the media works, you can see sometimes why people are trying to keep a lid on some of those things.
Yeah.
So what sort of conversation would you be recommending or encouraging, or how do you recommend organisations get the real stuff through, the authentic conversation, rather than just, you know, the sort of top line, what you think people want to know?
For me, is something about, you know, where we sort of speak. I think that we need to recognise that people speak differently in different forums, and also different people have different ways of communicating. So I mean this in the widest sense, you know, that they may, to have sort of online forums, to have informal places to speak, to have, you know, the formal meetings and so on, but just to have a huge breadth of variety. And for leaders and managers to be involved in all of them. And I think also, that, you know, I keep returning to this, but the idea of having an adult-to-adult conversation can't be sort of undervalued or overvalued. It's a particular sort of approach to speaking, which I think encourages sort of real engagement. Which is about, you know, mutual respect. You know, we're both people with ideas, and let's share them, rather than the sense that, you know, somebody is seeking approval from somebody else, or somebody somehow has a kind of a right to of judgment and so on. But I'm aware that everything that that what I'm saying sounds, I mean, I can see that people might think that my ideas are quite utopian. And one of the things that perhaps I haven't mentioned, which I think is essential to authenticity and giving people the freedom to authenticity, is the fact that that individuals within the organisation must also be aware that their actions have an impact on the organisation. So I think that, you know, I'm not sort of advocating some sort of free-for-all and chaos. You know, that everybody has a responsibility within the organisation not to expose it to undue risk, you know, to make sure that they're acting in the best interests of the organisation. And I also believe that if people are not acting in the interests of the organisation, then the organisation needs to act very quickly, because they can have a huge impact on those around them when it comes to things like engagement. So certainly organisations that I've worked with in the course of writing the book, for example, Timpson's, the shoe mending key cutting organisation, they have a brilliant sort of minimum specification way of communicating how to work in the organisation, which is that they give each of the shops, you know, I think it's four rules, which is, you know, sort of treat the customer well, give them a good customer experience, look presentable and be you know, polite and so on, and make sure all the money goes in the till. And apart from that, then use your imagination and go wild. But if people are acting against the interests of the organisation, then they also act incredibly quickly. They give them a fair chance, but, you know, but sort of moves taken. So I think that this is a kind of a route that demands awareness and mindfulness, rather than, you know, sort of a chaotic free-for-all.
I think that's a really good example, giving them, you know, very clear sort of, I don't know, sort of bottom line rules about what needs to happen, but then that gives you that freedom to be creative once you sort of know what you absolutely must do, which quite often is missing in organisations, isn't it, that sort of framework.
Well, that's right, and I think we find with the stores that they can be very reactive then to the kind of high street that's around them.
Yeah, and specific situations, yeah, exactly. Brilliant. Well, that's been really good, Lisa, and we have come to the end of the show. I told you it went quick. So it's been really interesting. Some really useful stuff in there, and I really encourage people to you know, read the book and find out some more about it. There's loads of stuff that we didn't get a chance to cover as well. So and, you know, some great case studies in there as well. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. So just to let you know, next week we have a bit of a Christmas surprise for you. Those of you who have been listening to the show for over a year may remember we did a marathon Christmas show live last year with some contributions from our listeners and from the movement. We have something that will have some contributions as well this year. It won't be the marathon event it was last year, and it'll be done slightly differently, but I will leave you to find out by tuning in next week how that's going to run. So thank you, and see you next time, or rather speak to you next time.